play expected long makes the audience look for wonders, that each scene should be a book, composed to all perfection. Each one comes and brings a play in his head with him. Up he sums what he would of a roaring girl have writ, if that he finds not here, he muse at it. Only we entreat you, think our scene cannot speak high, the subject being but mean. A roaring girl whose note till now never were shall fill with laughter our vast theatre. That's all which I dare promise. Tragic passion, and such grave stuff as this day out of fashion. I see attention sets wide ope her gates of hearing, and with covetous listening waits to know what girl this roaring girl should be, for of that tribe are many. One is she that roars at midnight in deep tavern bowls, that beats the watch and constables controls. Another roars in the daytime, swears, stabs, gives braves, yet sells her soul to the lust of fools and slaves. Both these are suburb roarers. Then there's beside a civil city roaring girl, whose pride, feasting and riding, shakes her husband's state, and leaves him roaring through an iron grate. None of these roaring girls is ours. She flies with wings more lofty. Thus her character lies. Yet what need characters when to give a guess is better than the person to express? But would you know who 'tis? Would you hear her name? She is called Mad Moll. Her life our acts proclaim.
Please insert play here. That was Sarah Golding performing the prologue to The Roaring Girl by the Thomases, Decker and Middleton. After we released this recording a couple of weeks ago, I had the pleasure of talking about the play with Professor Tracy Hill of Bath Spa University. We discussed the title character, Moll Cutpurse, who's not just a character in the play, but also a real-life figure of the time, Mary Frith, who was known for wearing male attire, and believed to have performed in this very play, the play about her. Otherwise, it's a fairly conventional city comedy, a love story about a couple who are separated by an overbearing father. But within this, we have this fascinating figure of Moll Cutpurse. So here is an edited version of my conversation with Professor Tracy Hill. So, tell me, how do you know this play?
Well, I taught it on and off over a number of years, and I'm hoping to teach it in the coming year, actually, so students can access it as a kind of living entity. That would be fantastic, particularly with comedies, as they so often just don't... They struggle to get it if they can't see it being acted out. The way we dealt with that last year with Night of the Burning Pestle, I got them to do a couple of scenes. We kind of blocked it out and then just got up and did it, and it totally transformed things for them. So The Roaring Girl is at least as good as The Night of the Burning Pestle, so I would hope that the same thing will apply, really.
Why do you want to teach this text?
Mainly because of Moll. You know, she's just an extraordinary character. She's kind of a combination of what Middleton and Decker can do with female characters. I mean, I would say that they are both, and collectively, individually and collectively, much better at staging, you know, good feisty female characters than Shakespeare ever was. And the fact that she was a real person adds a real spice to it. You know, that's how I pitched it to the students. I'm hoping to take my module next year. You know, I said this is not just a funny play with a real, pardon my French, kick-ass heroine, but, you know, she actually probably played herself on stage, and there is lots of documentary record of her behaviour, which is the sort of thing that students find extremely appealing.
Yes.
And also, funnily enough, because I haven't taught her for a few years, there are issues to do with her kind of cross-dressing and her kind of gender in definition, which I think are much, much more likely to kind of strike a chord with contemporary students than they would have done even 10 years ago.
Yes, the discourse on that has moved on considerably since when I was at university. and actually you can discuss things in a much more dynamic and a much more real world sense, I think.
Yes, than... I think so. There is some, you know, there's some fantastic sort of set piece speeches. Where Marlene and I like to lie on both sides of the bed by myself, all that kind of stuff, and the emphasis on costume and on clothing you know, dictating your identity / gender, and how difficult it is to determine that with Marlene, and she's this kind of strange hybrid creature, and she's described as a monster, and all those kinds of things. You know, I think you can both think about that in the context of anxieties about gender in the early 17th century and the sumptuary laws and all that, but you can also think about it in terms of the debates that are going on right now that students are going to be very aware of.
With that modern sensibility in mind, the RSC production reset it as a Victorian piece and got quite a lot of flack in terms of the reviews on that.
Rightly so.
And I didn't see the production, so I can't comment. So deciding where and when and how a production comes about, especially with the language that's used throughout the play, what one does with the setting is up for grabs. In my practice, I tend to say if it's very much of its own time in that sense, I would probably go for an original staging approach, but always with an ear to say what chimes with today.
Yeah, I absolutely. I think because there's a whole kind of Jacobean London world there, which I think it would be perverse to strip that out.
Yes.
To be honest, because it drives the play so much. You know, the scenes for the citizens particularly, and the whole sense of, you know, social mobility and shifting identities in London in this period. It also makes it part of a kind of a trend as well. You know, there's so many of these kinds of plays. What's really distinctive about this one, going back to the original kind of question, is the character of Mole herself. You know, she is unique. There is nothing else like her in the corpus of city comedy.
Yes, she is very much a human being. for obvious reasons, she is a human being.
But I think one of the things that is particularly significant about Mole, which may well make a difference to the character, to the real person, in fact, is the way that Middleton and Decker have her articulate, you know, very misogynistic ideas about women and then rebut them very vigorously. You know, that's, you obviously get the former in lots and lots of plays. You get the former in lots of other Middletons, actually, about the Revenge's tragedy and the Changeling. You know, they're stuffed full of misogynistic asides, like the whole thing is just accepted. In this instance, you know, she's very vocal, very articulate.
Well, the nice thing is you don't feel that she is somehow constrained by the conventions of the plot. Whereas with other characters, you feel that I am here and I'm doing this thing, and now at the end of the play, I must now do the expected thing and become this person. Whereas everybody else feels like they're acting, they're in a play and they're constrained by the play. You get the impression that she can just step out of it and say, right, I'm off.
She does wander around a lot. She kind of, you know, pops up. You know, citizens are discussing that, so the shops are discussing various things. And there she is, and now she's gone again, and I think that is absolutely brilliant on the part of Middleton and Decker, because that clearly reflects very much the real life experience of Mole Cutpurse in her own time in Amorphis. You know, she comes and goes. She's here, she's there, she's everywhere. And that's what the prologue, I think, brilliantly sets the audience up for. What the prologue does is basically say, we know you're already really interested in
this.
I see attention sets wide open her gates of hearing, and with covetous listening waits to know what tribe this roaring girl should be.
You know, it's very playful. It's very playful with what the audience's expectations are, what they might have imagined this spectacle is going to be, and doesn't actually even actually give any specific answers to what they're about to see next, as opposed to a much more straightforward narrative thrust, or even a straightforward, the play is now starting, you know, get yourselves ready. It's a playful introduction to what is this character, what is the difference between a real human being story and this mediated version that they're about to see.
And it's absolutely about her. There's no reference in the prologue whatsoever to the kind of sordid love plot, you know, which was basically extremely conventional in city comedies anyway.
Yes.
You know, none of the other characters get a look in. It's just a presentation of Mole, because that's what people want to see.
Looking through my notes as to what stood out, and it's a case of, I don't think I've got any notes on any of the other characters at all.
They're kind of pushing the boundaries of those conventions as well. You know, we've seen many, many, many times over the last 12 years or so, you know, plots which center on a young couple who, you know, who's separated by, it goes quite to classical drama, obviously, separated usually by her father, you know, and there are all sorts of shenanigans as to how to bypass that and all those kinds of things. And you've got the tailor who just says nothing but rude jokes, and, you know, you've got all sorts of things that people would have immediately recognised. But what they've done is they've thrown this bomb, which is Mole Fris, in the middle of it all. Students do respond to this play, as far as I recall, and I'm anticipating that, you know, the next batch will do so too, maybe even more so for the reasons we've been discussing. And also because I'm going to take some of the locations on the play as well. We're going to go to where the Fortune Theatre was. We're going to go to all the places in the city, apart from possibly not going to Luke Gradian Fields, but certainly go, you know, into St Paul's and various other places to kind of somehow actualise it, make it seem more real, get them to kind of try and imagine these scenes being played out in this particular location. I do that all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, in terms of solid-state geography then, how distant are the locations within the play to each other?
Well, Brentford's obviously a long way out, as is Ware. I mean, but these are places that are always referred to, but hardly ever anybody ever goes there, because obviously, you know, you just know Brentford stands for, you know, places of resort and so on. And the joke is that it is a long way outside of London. Mm. But the others, they're all within walking distance, obviously. It's a very small place. The playhouse is up at Cripplegate, is obviously on the very margins of the city. But, you know, you can get from there to St Paul's in 15 minutes, probably. You know, and most of the locations that are closer to each other than that, you've got references to churches, which are about two streets away from the cathedral, that sort of thing.
I'd assumed, by the nature of the geography of the city, it would be something like that, but that had never actually occurred to me, because that's one of the things about, well, city comedies, is they tend to refer to the city.
They do, but I mean, it kind of goes beyond that, usually. There's usually, you know, very specific kind of resonances here. I mean, I'm pretty sure that the shop scene, it doesn't say whereabouts in London the shops are, but the kinds of shops they are, and the sort of the emphasis on sort of fashion and so on, it sounds very Blackfriars-y to me, particularly Feathers, actually, because Blackfriars was famed for its feather makers and sellers. Maybe not, but it just doesn't feel like Cheapside. It feels more like Blackfriars, but then that's just maybe me just imagining things. But that's very close to Paul's, obviously. It's just across the road. I think it's probably quite widely taught, you know, which is why, you know, why initially you caught my interest, because any of us who teach non-Shakespearean plays all the time, like I do, you know, I just come up against this constantly, and it's enormously frustrating.
Yes.
Not just with the comedies. I mean, there's a particular issue with the comedies, but, you know, with all of them, my students are desperate to see The Changing, they're desperate to see Tis Pity, She's a Whore, they're desperate to see Revenge of Tragedy. So, yeah, but then you have a list as long as your arm, really, of course, which ones should be a priority. They should all be a priority. I mean, there's a couple of bits and bobs. Chouts did some videos, the Shakespeare in London Theatres project, which is kind of defunct now, actually, did some videos with some very good actors, some of the Dolphin's back actors, but they're only the odd scene, you know, you don't get the entirety of the play, so it's, in some ways, it's even more tormenting for the students, because they get a little glimpse of what they could be seeing, and then it's gone.
The Roaring Girl, how would you just, in a sentence, how would you sell it to an unbeliever?
It's got one of the most striking original central figures in the whole canon of early modern drama. The contemporary resonances are stronger now than they've ever been. It's written by two writers at the peak of their powers. It's very funny. And you will never forget Mole once you've seen her.
Any other plays you'd like to? Any other plays you'd like to talk about while we're here?
Doom, please, 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 do Michaelmas Term. It is such a good play.
Oh yes.
Just make sure that that's on the list.
Any other ones you'd love to see?
This wouldn't be possible within the constraints of your setup, I don't think. But having done some of the Decathlon at Stratford, and others got me reading some of the Lord Mayor shows that Decca wrote. Just amazing. That's my specialism, pageantry. Just doing bits of some of those works, you know, Decca and Middleton both wrote a number of them. They are performance pieces, after all. I think that would be just wonderful. Because then also they're written in a completely different style. And you read it and you think, you know, you read something particularly on Monday and you're thinking, oh, God, these dreadful, dreadful old-fashioned 14ers. Oh, God, it's grim. And then you actually hear them delivered, and you think, oh, well, of course, what we're trying to do is to be bombastic and emphatic and cut through a lot of crowd noise, you know, and actually sort of declaim, and they declaim like crazy, and it works. In that context, it works brilliantly. So, you know, just as a kind of interesting juxtaposition to the kind of stage plays, it would be good. In so many ways, it would be good. It would be good to extend the canon of these writers to think about, you know, a Decca play alongside a Decca show, those kinds of things. That would be my absolute dream.
Well,
you are.
I mean, you say that's beyond, possibly beyond our setup. Actually, I don't think it would be.
They are. I mean, they're also kind of, you know, location-specific street theatre. So, you know, that dimension would be... I mean, it would be absolutely incredible to reconstruct one. I would absolutely love that, but...
I mean, in terms of a text, we could definitely, because the number of speakers are not necessarily actually very large, though it depends on the nature of the
No,
the
they
piece.
Aren't. I mean, there's some...
So we could definitely...
A good one to look at would be the 1613 one, to answer the truth, because it's very dramatic. It's got more of a sort of a narrative running through it. They tend to be very, very episodic and obviously very kind of tableau-based. This one, you've got some good little set pieces. You've got a kind of fight between... Zeal and Error and Envy, which ends with Zeal throwing a firework at Error's chariot. So that was quite hard to stage, but you know, I think it would work really well as a kind of a piece. I think I'm sure it would come across really effectively.
And that was Professor Tracy Hill of Bath Spa University. Thank you very much again for talking to me. You've been listening to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. I'm Robert Crichton, and next up we should be releasing Volume 2 of the John Hayward Complete Works. We're releasing Gentleness and Nobility and The Four Ps. We'll be releasing that and a whole host of other odds and ends before we make our merry way to the Edinburgh Festival, where hopefully we will be recording some of the macro plays. But till then, I've been Robert Crichton. Please subscribe to this podcast via your various devices or follow us on Twitter at Beyond Shakespeare.